Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll meet Juno Symphony conductor candidate Wesley Scholes. Aaron Hood will be here to showcase his new study on melting glaciers. We'll talk with Brandon Howard about Tiles and Fire, this month's first Friday exhibit at COPA. And we'll find out about this week's FASD forum at Centennial Hall. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous women from across the country are taking part in a week-long series of events this month aimed at raising awareness of missing, murdered, and abused Native women. As Jim Kent reports, the Sing Our Rivers Red program includes a variety of presentations, along with a unique art project that women of all races are being asked to take part in.
More than 1,181 Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or reported missing in Canada since 1980. Here in the U.S., Native American women are 2.5 times more likely to be sexually assaulted than non-Native women. 70% of those incidents are committed against Native women by non-Natives. Tanea Winder organized the Sing Our Rivers Red events with longtime friend Hanaba Blue. She says a key part of the program is the traveling art exhibit that will present 1,181 individual earrings representing each of the missing or murdered Indigenous women in Canada.
The earring exhibit was my idea, and I just thought of it because just what the earrings could symbolize and symbolize the missing women. And it's very important to us to not, like, clump them together in a vase or something, but to show each of them individually, just an artistic and visual representation of these women.
Winder says women are being asked to donate either one earring from a set that's missing its partner or one from a complete set, with the idea of wearing the remaining earring in memory of a missing or murdered Indigenous woman. Events scheduled for the Sing Our Rivers Red program take place in Fargo, North Dakota, and Moorhead, Minnesota, the week of Valentine's Day, to coincide with similar events taking place in Canada. They include a poetry speak out, a self-defense and self-empowerment workshop for women, a concert by Rosebud Sioux rapper Frank Wan, a march, and a rally. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Meanwhile, a national gathering is being planned in Alberta, Canada, to honor murdered and missing Indigenous women. The Spirit of Our Sisters Gathering National Conference is scheduled for the last week in May. The meeting will include the sharing of information and discussions about efforts to raise awareness of the issue. Organizers say the focus is dedicated to the grassroots movement, but there will be opportunities for government and others to participate. The idea that traditional diets are best for coastal Alaska Native people is further being confirmed by the discovery of a gene deficiency that does not allow their systems to process sugar. Lori Townsend reports.
Dr. Matthew Hirschfeld is the Director of Maternal Child Health Services at the Alaska Native Medical Center. The gene deficiency causes a condition known as CSID. Hirschfeld says the addition of sugar into so many processed foods is not good for anyone, but is especially bad for coastal Alaska Native people.
The place that we're seeing it most in Alaska right now is coastal regions, so Yupik and Inupiaq populations of Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and Barrow.
Hirschfeld says both parents must have the gene for it to impact their children. He says babies exposed to sugar in infant formulas or other foods can fail to thrive because the diet of coastal Alaska Natives was for thousands of years nearly carbohydrate-free.
The traditional diet in those regions is all fat, all protein. It's like an Atkins diet on steroids. And so introducing sugar into the diet 2 to 3 generations ago wouldn't give them enough time to be able to adapt to the more westernized diet in those areas.
Tests for the problem used to be invasive biopsies of the small intestine, but now a simple blood test can determine if the deficiency exists. For National Native News, I'm Lori Townsend in Anchorage.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Gathering of Nations to the UNM Pitt, April 24th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. Supported by the Tribal Telecom and Technology Conference, Weaving Pathways Across the Digital Divide. The annual Tribal Telecom Golf Classic will be held May 4, 2015 at the Isleta Eagle Golf Course. Info at tribaltelecomconference.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. And now in the studio with me is the executive director of the Juno Symphony, Sarah Radke Brown. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
Nice to have you in the studio.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. And also here with us is guest symphony conductor candidate Wesley Scholes. Welcome to Juno, Wesley.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Sarah, why don't we start with you? Let us know what's going on with the symphony these days.
Sure. Wesley will be conducting our concerts this Friday. I'm getting February and Friday mixed up. Saturday and Sunday at JDHS. The concert on Saturday is at 8 p.m. The concert on Sunday is at 3 p.m. Wesley is one of three candidates to present our season this year. We had Troy Quinn back in November, and Wesley, of course, this weekend. And then Jeremy Briggs Roberts will be presenting the third and final candidate concert at the end of March. So we're really excited to see what Wesley has to bring to the table.
Absolutely, and you'll be presenting a show called American Brilliance, is that right?
Yeah, American Brilliance, sure. whether it's... I don't think we're going to have a trivia quiz at the concert, but I think the brilliance comes through the music, I hope.
Yeah, I bet it will. Why don't we start, let's learn a little bit about you, Wesley. Where are you from and how did you get into music?
Yeah, well, I currently live in Seattle, Washington, and conduct a number of orchestras in that area. And, like many people, picked up an instrument when I was very young. I didn't have a choice. I was 3 years old. I was told what to do by mom. So I started on the cello through the Suzuki program and kept playing and then picked up percussion and then decided, to go to college and try to make a go at a career in this.
Right. And I've always been interested when people sort of make a decision from performance into conducting. Do you still do both or have you sort of gone towards conducting?
Yeah, I conduct full time, but it was sort of a moment in the middle of my undergraduate career where I was a performance major and I happened to be in Vienna and I was taking lessons with the timpanist of the Vienna Symphony and I was sitting on stage behind him at a concert and listening and watching and just feeling what it was like to be there, and it just sort of like hit me like, you know what? I want to conduct. I want to be the guy with the stick and work with these musicians and have that connection with audiences through music. So that's what I'm here hopefully to do this weekend.
Okay, and who are some of your favorite composers? This one's going to be sort of focused on American composers, but can you tell us about some of your favorites in general?
Yeah, the answer I always give is my favorite composer is whatever I'm studying at the moment. And, it's sort of a blasé answer, but, it's because there's so much great music out there, that all of the great names, you can come up with a list of dozen pieces. And then some names of composers you've never heard of and that have great music. And that's kind of a part of this weekend's concert. I'm bringing to the audience a piece that I really love by a composer that I think highly of, and that's Kevin Putz. He lives in New York, and we're going to perform his Millennium Canons, which I think will grip you from the beginning through all 8 minutes, but it's a joyous ride through tonality and just exuberance, happiness, brilliance.
Well, looking forward to it. Thinking about conducting, what would you say are, a couple tips? What are some things that you find effective conductors do?
Yeah, where I learn the most is watching other conductors. you know, I'm fortunate to live in Seattle, and I am the conducting fellow of the Seattle Symphony, and part of that job allows me to sit in the seats during the rehearsals of the Seattle Symphony and see all these guest conductors come through the door. You know, they're doing music. Sometimes it's familiar, but what's different is their view on it and how they work with the orchestra and how they inspire them, what they unlock within the music. And for me, that's the greatest inspiration.
Okay. And sorry, we're sort of getting into the interview part of it. thinking about when you are up on the stand, can you tell us what's that like? A lot of us haven't had a chance to do that, or probably never will. What are some of the ways you're communicating with the musicians?
Yeah, you know, what I always try to convey first to the orchestra, and then beyond that orchestra to the audience, is, you know, what is a composer's intent? You know, what message is trying to come across in the music? And not necessarily talking about, you know, a specific idea, you know, that we're trying to convey, you know, the idea of unicorns, you know, but perhaps just, you know, where is this piece going? You know, what is the overall mood of the piece? You know, how can we begin it and end it and take the audience on a journey? And so, you know, my job up on the podium is to communicate with the musicians with some words in rehearsal and then performance through gesture and facial expressions and communicating flow and time and pace and phrase and all that sort of stuff so that we can kind of breathe life into the ink that's on the page.
Sure. All right. And so if this works out, you'll be coming to Juno. Tell us a little bit about yourself off the podium. What do you like to do on your free time?
Yeah, well, you know, one of my favorite hobbies is to run, and so I like to do a marathon or two each year. And so, you know, it's been a mild winter here in January, so I can get out and run. I guess when the snow comes out, I'll have to get some snowshoes.
Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about how this whole process works? You
sure.
have these three great candidates. It's going to be really hard to choose, I'm sure. How does it work?
Yeah, it's a two-year process, really, because all of last year we reviewed over 70 applications, and we put together a search committee. It was made up of board members and musicians in the orchestra and community members and symphony supporters. And they reviewed every one of those applications and narrowed it down to just three people. And it was quite the process, and they interviewed each, you know, they narrowed it down to, I think, maybe 12, and at that point they interviewed each conductor through, I think, Skype.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had Skype interviews. And they decided these were the three guys, and, you know, and it's not just about, you know, their baton technique or their programming or, you know, their fundraising capabilities. You know, it really also came down to, are these three we thought these three were going to be the best fit for Juno, you know, could really absorb the community and step in that way. So really, we really wanted them to want Juno to feel like a second home. And so, so far, we've been very lucky. So we're really excited to, like I said, see what Wes is going to do, and of course our last candidate in March. And but they have all been great so far. So
good, Wesley. What has it been like for you so far working with the Juno musicians? How have you been communicating with them, and how have you been preparing for this show in particular?
Yeah, we've had a couple of rehearsals so far, and, you know, we've gone through all of the music that's on the program. We've revisited a few pieces. This week, we sort of accelerate our efforts. We have a few more rehearsals added on to this week as we head toward the weekend, you know, but everyone's, you know, been very engaged. They're very aware, and they have big, wide, open ears. They've been very receptive and positive to feedback. You know, but part of conducting, I always, you know, equivocate to, it's like dating. You know, you go on a kind of a first date, and the first rehearsal is kind of the first date where things are sometimes a little awkward, you know, and you're both trying to present yourselves in good ways and, you know, and as well as trying to reveal your true colors. And then as you head toward the performance, you know, things go a little more steady. You begin to understand one another, and you make better and better connections. So, you know, I think we're off to a good start. It's been a lot of fun, and I look forward to the journey.
Yeah, remind us the name of your friend composer that you'll be presenting on Saturday and Sunday, and tell us a little bit about what we should look for in the performances.
Yeah, again, you know, I wish I could call him a friend. He's more famous than me, so I don't know him yet. But Kevin Putz, you know, is the composer of the first work on the program, Millennium Canons. And, you know, but there's many delightful things on the program. You know, something audiences will certainly recognize is Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. We're very excited to be doing that piece. It hasn't been performed. We looked it up since about 1996 here in Juneau. So this is sort of a you know, over 20 years later, bring it back sort of thing. And so we have a really great soloist who's a friend of mine, Johan Botis. And he's a delightful individual, and he's played this many times, and I am certain the audience will be thrilled by his personality behind the piano as well as off stage.
I bet. Well, Wesley Schultz, Sarah Radke Brown, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Is there anything else either of you would like to add?
Yeah, come to the concert Saturday and Sunday. Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 3 p.m. There is a concert conversation with Wes 1 hour before each concert. So be there at JDHS.
And remind us where to get tickets, Sarah?
You can get tickets at Hearthside Books, The Jack, or you can go to our website at www.junosymphony.org.
Sounds good. Wes, anything else?
Yeah, please say hi. Come up and say hello. I'd love to meet you.
Great. Thanks, you too.
Thank you. Thank you.
Programming is made possible in part by Juno's Own Alaska Pure Mountain Spring Water, available in Juno stores or delivered in 5-gallon jugs to homes and offices. 780-4262.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. It's about 21 minutes after the hour, and joining me in the studio now is Professor Dr. Aaron Hood from the University of Alaska Southeast. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. And among other things that we're going to talk about today is your recent article in Nature Geoscience. Why don't you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so we did a study that was actually conceived a couple years ago, and the basic idea of the study was to look at how much carbon is stored in glaciers on Earth. There's a tremendous amount of interest in the amount of water stored in glaciers, how it's changing over time, because obviously that changes sea level as we take water that's stored on land off land and put it into the ocean. But there's been a lot less research looking at what's in that water that's coming off the land. And one of the things that could be important, we thought, was organic carbon. So we collected data from all over the Earth, actually from Antarctica and Greenland and the Alps and Alaska and, you know, a lot of different glaciated regions. And we put all this data together, and that allowed us to make kind of the first estimates of what's stored in the glaciers and then also what, how rapidly this carbon will be released over time.
Sure. In very simple terms, can you explain to us what organic carbon is and how it gets into glacial ice?
Yeah, so organic carbon is essentially when you make tea, you're making organic carbon. So you're taking organic material, tea leaves or ground up, and you're dissolving it in water. And so you can think of it as being like organic acids. And those are important because they're metabolized by microbes at the very bottom of the food chain. So the microbes are using that for their food. So it's carbon, organic carbon, that can support the bottom of the food chain, essentially. And it gets into glacier ice. There's a variety of sources. You can find it in precipitation. You can get it on the surface of a glacier where algae and other microbes are growing in little sort of ponds on the glacier surface. You can get it from fossil fuel combustion byproducts that fall out in precipitation as well. So there's a number of different sources. And then there's also sometimes carbon sources under glaciers as well. So the water infiltrates, the glacier goes underneath and picks up stuff from there as well.
I think it's interesting because often these days when we think of carbon, especially when it's paired with oxygen as carbon dioxide,
yeah,
sort of has a pejorative sort of image, right? It's causing greenhouse and climate change and all that, but this almost sounds like a positive form of carbon. Is that right?
Well, it is a positive form of carbon. I mean, all aquatic ecosystems have dissolved organic carbon in them, and really our interest here was to figure out, okay, how much is in glaciers? How rapidly is it being released? And then ultimately, the question will be, what are going to be the impacts for the rivers and the estuaries that are receiving this organic carbon? And so, you know, that's why we wanted to make this estimate in the first place. But certainly, some of it actually ends up being converted into carbon dioxide eventually. But I wouldn't say it's not a global warming issue per se, except for the glaciers themselves changing.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got this data, your team, and some of the stuff that you do at UAS and with your students and the research. It seems like you have a great job.
It is a great job. There's a lot to it. Well, this particular project, so Jason Fellman, who's at UAS, is a research professor there, and he and I worked on it, and we collaborated with someone in Europe, someone up at the USGS Alaska Science Center, and then someone who works at the Woods Hole Research Center on the East Coast. And basically, we started out just by looking in the literature and by contacting people that had taken ice and water samples from glaciers all over the Earth and tried to, that had organic carbon information. And so we got this huge database of organic carbon data from as many glaciers on Earth as we could. Obviously, there's, you know, 10% of the Earth's surface is the Earth's land area, I should say, is covered with glaciers. So it's a lot of area, and there are not that many samples when you think about how much area it is. But we got as many as we could, and Then we looked at the glacier data that's available in terms of how glaciers are changing, and we put it all together, and that's how we were able to make these estimates.
And can you tell us a little bit about the field work that you guys do and with your students? I know you all get out a lot. We have the ice field and the Mendenhall Glacier right here.
Yeah, so we have a couple projects right now looking at glaciers and what's going on sort of local glaciers. We've done a lot of work on Herbert Glacier and Mendenhall Glacier, and so we go and we sample snow and ice on the glaciers. Then we do a lot of sampling in the rivers out in front of the glaciers, and so we're trying to understand the material that's coming onto the surface of the glacier in terms of carbon and other constituents that we're interested in, like phosphorus and nitrogen. How much of those, you know, how much is getting onto the glacier, and then how much is coming out the bottom into these rivers and then eventually being exported down to estuaries as well. So it's a lot of, we've really gone from on the glaciers to the rivers and down into the estuaries trying to trace this glacier material on its path to the ocean.
I know you spend time both teaching and researching. How would you compare the time?
They're very complementary activities in the sense that you learn a lot from researching that you can bring into the classroom. And so I like showing the students that I work with, the newest research stuff that we have. And I think it sort of brings it alive for them. And it's also interesting that you see from interacting with students what people have difficulty understanding or kind of it somehow helps you develop more research questions by interacting with people like that. And so it also has a kind of a positive feedback on the research, in addition to the fact that a lot of UAS students have the opportunity to get out and be part of, my projects, and a lot of other faculty have projects that involve undergraduate students at UAS.
Aaron, if somebody wants to read the article in Nature Geoscience, I suspect they could go to that website, or is there an easier way to find it?
You could go to the Nature Geoscience website, and I'm pretty sure that it's open access there. I actually have to check it. It just came out today on the sort of table of contents, so I could check. If you can't find it there, you could always email me at my UAS email address, and I'd be happy to send anyone a PDF that was interested.
Tell us a little bit about what goes into making or writing a paper like this. We've already talked a little bit about the research and how you've done all that. How long have you and Jason and friends been working on this?
Well, publishing articles in the peer-reviewed literature is a fairly time-consuming because we sent in a draft probably last spring, and then they sent it out to three reviewers, and you don't know who the reviewers are, and then they give back comments to see, assess whether or not it should be published, and then you have to make changes based on those comments, and then it was sent out to the reviewers again, and then it came back to us, and again, and we made more changes, and then finally by December, then the journal said, we're satisfied with the changes and the reviewers are satisfied with it. So sometimes it takes several iterations, and it could take, 6 or 9 months is not uncommon between finishing a draft and then actually sending it in and getting it accepted.
Wow. How do you feel now that it's been published?
Oh, it feels good to get it done, and there's always more in the hopper, so it's kind of on to the next one.
Professor Aaron Hood, thank you for coming on the show today and telling us about your paper. What's the title?
Storage and Release of Organic Carbon from Glaciers and Ice Sheets is the title.
All right. Will you be doing any presentations of this paper in the near future?
Not directly of this paper. I mean, I do a training session at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center for the interpreters there in the spring, and I try to work a lot of this stuff into it. But sometime probably in the not too distant future, I'll have another evening at Egan or something like that and talk about some of these things.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on the show today and telling us about it.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 3rd of February, 2015. It was on this day, 1959, that Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson died in a plane crash outside Clear Lake, Iowa. They were on a horrendous tour of the upper Midwest. Buddy Holly, 22, did not want to go along. He was sick of touring. His wife was pregnant, but he needed the money. It was a cold winter. They traveled on a school bus. The heat wasn't working. They slept sitting up on the hard seats. Holly's drummer had frostbitten feet. They played one night in Green Bay, drove all the way down to Clear Lake, Iowa for the next show at the Surf Ballroom. And there Buddy Holly decided to charter a plane to take them to Moorhead, Minnesota for their next stop so he could rest up and get his laundry done. It's the birthday of the novelist Paul Auster, born Newark, 1947, worked for a while on an oil tanker in the Gulf of Mexico, made enough money to move to Paris, where he tried writing for a while. A few months later, he got a phone call from someone who asked for the Pinkerton Detective Agency, and Auster said, "I'm sorry you got the wrong number," but later thought about what might have happened if he'd decided to impersonate a detective. And that was his next novel, City of Glass, came out in 1985, about a mystery writer who pretends to be a detective so he can see what it's like. It's the birthday of James Michener, born in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, 1907. Never knew who his parents were. He was taken to an orphanage as an infant, adopted by a Quaker woman. When he was 14, he hitchhiked all over the country, at a time when a person could do that. He read Dickens's novels as a boy and the works of Balzac, went off to college, he was a good student, got a full scholarship to Swarthmore, went into the Navy during World War II, was stationed in the Solomon Islands, wrote some stories and sketches about life in the Navy, which was published as Tales of the South Pacific in 1947. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and 2 years later it became Rodgers and Hammerstein's hit musical South Pacific. He wrote nearly 40 books, including Hawaii, Chesapeake, Alaska, Texas, which sold an estimated 75 million copies, and he gave away a good deal of his money, at least $100 million, leaving $10 million to Swarthmore, his alma mater. And it's the birthday of Gertrude Stein, born Allegheny, Pennsylvania, 1874, grew up in Oakland, spent some childhood in Vienna, Paris, settled in Paris, where she and her lover Alice B. Toklas established a salon where they welcomed writers and artists, including Picasso, Matisse, Hemingway, T.S. Eliot, and James Joyce. Here's a poem for today by Wallace Stevens, The Snowman. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. The Snowman by Wallace Stevens, from his collected poems, published by Faber and Faber and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
As a girl, I was taught the importance of respect for my family, respect for myself. Today, I see domestic violence and sexual abuse hurting our children. If you or someone you love is a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, there is help. Asking for help changes everything.
Together we can make a difference. Visit dps.alaska.gov/cdvsa.
And you're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. It's about 36 minutes after the hour. And now in the studio with me is Trish Smith. Welcome, Trish.
Hello.
Nice to have you here. And Wendy Barrett. Welcome, Wendy.
Hi, thank you.
And Trish, can we start with you? You have a long title. I would like to have you introduce yourself, please.
My name is Trish Smith. I work for Volunteers of America, Alaska in Anchorage, and I am the Community Educator and Outreach Manager there.
Okay, thank you. And how about you, Wendy?
My name is Wendy Barrett. I work for Stone Soup Group. I'm the Positive Behavior Support Program Manager there. And I do a lot of the same kinds of things like Trish does, education and training, outreach. I'm also a mother of a daughter that has neurological disability.
Okay, and we're here today to talk about the FASD Forum that begins tomorrow at Centennial Hall, a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us... Either one of you, can you start off and describe a little bit about what the forum is going to be like?
Okay, the forum is going to start at about 8 o'clock in the morning. There is a $35 fee. It is open to the public. They're going to be talking about things like FASD in the education system, FASD in the criminal justice system, what is an FASD diagnosis, the effects of trauma. On a family who have children that experience or a family member that experience FASD. And then nutrition. Nutrition is a big part of recovery and rehab for those kinds of individuals.
Okay. And I suspect, you know, so far I hear target audience teachers, care providers, families. Trish, can you tell us a little bit more about the kind of folks that could benefit from this forum?
All folks could benefit from this forum because, as we know, FASD is not discriminating against anyone, and so you might come across someone that experiences FASD in whatever walk of life you choose to go on. So the legal system, educational system, any kind of professional system, someone that is impacted by FASD could be there.
And can you tell us a little bit more about FASD in general? How it's caused, and a little bit more about that?
It is caused by a mom drinking while she is pregnant. So it because it is a spectrum, there's a wide range of how a person could be impacted, from severe, which would be the medical diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome, to very minor that you wouldn't even know. And, of course, a lot of people are looking for facial features to identify someone as impacted by FASD, but we now know that less than 90% are going to actually have the facial features. They will just have behaviors that will be different. So that's what we want to encourage everyone to understand, that what FASD is or looks like is different.
And it is 100% preventable.
Okay. Wendy, what are some of the behaviors that an individual with FASD might display?
So individuals with FASD have problems with executive functioning, so the day-to-day task may be difficult for them. They process information differently than an atypical person might. So you're saying one thing, they're hearing something else. Sequencing is usually a problem. You know, they have difficulties following more than one instruction, those kind of things.
And, Trish, you mentioned that it's 100% preventable. Is there any amount of alcohol that a mother can drink while pregnant that's okay, or is it zero tolerance?
Zero. There's none that we know, no research to say it's okay to have this much. Then we have the confusion of one drink. Mm-hmm. If they're saying one drink is okay, if a OBGYN is saying one drink's okay, what is that? To me, I go to a store and get a soda pop, and maybe I'm getting one of those big, you know, 42-ounce drinks, and that's one drink for me. Whereas mm-hmm. when we're talking about alcohol, they're much smaller amounts. 8 ounces, you know, is a drink of for some, and then some drinks like a Mai Tai might have what we would consider 3 servings in it. So somebody would think, well, a Mai Tai, that's one drink, but there's actually the equivalent of 3 alcoholic amounts of a beverage in there.
I see. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the lectures or some of the presentations that are going to be taking place at the forum?
Okay, we have some presentations on, you know, FASD and the education system. And so, you know, how, you know, individuals with FASD are impacted, you know, by the education system and vice versa in ways of, you know, addressing the behaviors that, you know, we have talked about, the accommodations that are needed. Sometimes, you know, teachers are kind of at a loss as to what, you know, to do about some of those behaviors, what kind of strategies to use. So there's going to be a session. Myself and Megan Clark, one of my parent navigators, we're actually going to do a session on strategies and what kind of strategies to use. There's going to be a session on advocating for adults and juveniles in the criminal justice system. So oftentimes, as Trish mentioned, they may not be, you know, diagnosed yet, so they might need a diagnosis. Somebody says, you know, they've got some strange behaviors. We don't really know why, so assessments might be needed. The other factor is that, you know, taking into account, you know, their sentencing. And so, you know, is a judge able to, you know, look at the disability, you know, in support of, you know, the sentencing that they're passing down? We're going to talk about understanding the FASD diagnosis, the assessments, the kind of assessments that are used. What do you do with it after you get it? Going to talk about FASD and the effects of trauma on the family, because it does, you know, cause a lot of trauma. There's a lot of grief issues sometimes associated, you know, with the diagnosis. Once family members realize that, you know, this is preventable, but now I have a family member, a child even, that has this disability. The nutrition piece of it, and especially associated with people who have substance abuse issues and are in recovery, how important it is, you know, the nutrition side of things, what kind of foods they need to be eating, what kind of, you know, health and exercise, diet, you know, they need to be following, those kind of things.
Like you said, Trish, something for just about everybody.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If somebody wants to attend, how should they go about signing up?
They can go online. There's a website, www.ttclms.org/class. But I think the easiest way would be to just drop in tomorrow at the Centennial Hall. It starts at 8 o'clock. You can register at the door. And it is $35, and there's a lot of good information there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Trish Smith, Wendy Barrett, thanks for coming on the show today. Anything else either of you would like to add?
Just remember, it is 100% preventable.
Right.
Thank you both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services in the Jordan Creek Center. Northern Audiology offers diagnostic medical hearing expertise and digital technology hearing instruments. 789-6780.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 3rd. It's about 12 minutes to the top of the hour. We are just hearing a piece by Midori. She's going to be playing as part of Juno Jazz and Classics Concert Series at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium on Tuesday, February 10th at 7:30. So a week from today, tickets at jazzandclassics.org. Now in the studio with me is Brandon Howard. He's the new artistic coordinator at the Canvas. Welcome, Brandon.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott.
Yeah, and we got to talk to Chris Taylor yesterday, who's going to go to New York to make some art for a while.
Yeah, well earned. Yeah, he's going to get to go to New York and work on his own work for a while. He's been doing so much work with the Canvas, he hasn't had much time to focus on his own paintings.
And now you are the new artistic coordinator. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's some big shoes to fill. it's a big step up from, you know, previously being the ceramic studio manager. So it's going to be a much more diverse role, and I can't wait. I'm really thrilled, really excited to start.
Yeah, how will it be different? What are some ideas you have?
So, you know, Chris's role has been managing the studio that all the artists work in, finding teachers to teach community classes, developing curriculum, hanging shows, finding artists to show in the gallery. I mean, there's just so much that goes into it. Working on events, and I'm really excited to get to start hanging the shows. I'm really excited to get to solicit from local talented artists that maybe don't show so often, that we haven't seen in town, and get to expose the community to what great talent we have here in Juneau. And also look forward to bringing in some outside artists, because, you know, being in Juneau, sometimes you kind of feel a little bit like you're on an island. It's nice to see that outside influence, and it's fantastic when they come here. You know, MK right now has a bunch of folks in town doing that big puppet project, and things like that just bring a lot of value to the community.
And speaking of outside folks, can we talk about the new ceramics year-old job?
Yeah, so we were really excited. We got to bring on a new person to manage the ceramic studio, a really talented young ceramicist, Mercedes Munoz. And last name might sound familiar. She is the granddaughter of Ree Munoz. And she just finished up a BFA in Montana, and she comes in with a lot of great ideas, a lot of great talent, and I mean, we couldn't be luckier to have such a talented and capable person coming into the ceramic studio.
Well, that's great. We'll look forward to meeting her here on a Juno afternoon sometime.
Oh, yeah.
So a minute ago you were talking about starting new shows or new projects. Tiles and Fire, that was one of your ideas.
Yeah, so downtown, right now it's all painted up with the, you know, the Juno Will You Mural Me sign that Chris and Catherine over at the Canvas put up a while ago. And over the summer we did a great community event. You stopped in, you did a piece on it. Thank you so much. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
And we did a big pit firing, and people decorated tiles, and then we put them into a big bonfire. And after that, it's kind of been a mystery for folks. You know, the fall sets in, the winter sets in, and you can't put up a mural during that time. And a lot of folks have been asking if they could see the tiles, how'd they turn out. They turn out beautiful. And we're really excited to get to give folks a sneak peek at how they turned out. And we're going to be hanging some of them at COPA. And it's going to be a really informative exhibit, give people an idea of what the final mural is going to be like, let people in on the process, people who didn't get to come to the pit fire, and we're going to have information about the process and photos from it, so that people who weren't there can see what it was all about and kind of see what the vision is for the final product, which is going to be an 8x12 tile mural downtown.
And briefly, Brandon, could you paint the scene for our listeners of what that event looked like at Sandy Beach?
Yeah, we made in-house about 200 ceramic tiles, 6x6 ceramic tiles, and folks came in and decorated the tiles with various colorants. We had copper wire and steel wool and all these things that you put onto a ceramic tile or any ceramic piece before you do a pit firing. And a pit firing is you dig a pit, you fill it with sawdust and paper and wood, you put your pieces in, and then you build a giant bonfire and light it up. And it was a huge fire, really hot. It's a pretty violent process. You know, I'm not going to lie. We lost a few tiles, and we're going to be showing some of the broken tiles. We'll probably epoxy them because a lot of the broken ones are beautiful in their own right. And you just let the fire burn down, and when everything's cleaned out, we went in and collected all the pieces, boxed them up, and this week I'm scrubbing and varnishing them. And on Friday, they'll be up at COPA for everybody to take a peek at.
Yeah, what time does that show start?
It starts at 4 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I would add one thing to your description. It was a Saturday, wasn't it?
It was Saturday.
It started late morning, went mm-hmm. into the night. Hundreds of people came through, participated.
Yeah, we had an incredible turnout.
All age groups.
Mm-hmm.
It was a decent day there on Sandy Beach, if I remember.
Yeah, we had a little bit of rain, but ended up clearing up. We got a really nice group photo that we're going to have hanging up there. Mark, who owns COPA, was actually there that day. And, man, he was like a big kid with the bonfire. So I'm excited that he's getting to host the event. And another great thing about it is I think people will be able to recognize their tiles. So folks who are at the event can come to COPA and get to point out which ones they're responsible for. And then when they're up downtown in the mural, you'll still be able to recognize that.
Yeah, when do you suspect that'll go up?
So we still have some work to do on porcelain tiles that we're going to be making at the canvas. We have two different dates as goals. We have a very kind of pipe dream date of early summer, you know, if mm-hmm. everything were to run perfectly, early summer. But realistically, probably August. You know, things in the real world take way more time than they take in my head.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, that's going to be great. I can't wait to see it.
Oh, me too.
It's really going to add to the beauty of downtown Juneau. All right. So to see this installation, if you will, in progress, this community art project, you can go to COPA on Friday at 4 o'clock, 4:30.
Yep.
That's part of First Friday.
Yep.
And check out these tiles. How are you going to display them?
I'm actually pretty excited about the display. I'm building some wood shelving for them that it'll kind of highlight them really nicely. It'll be a simple display. That way we don't have to put too many holes in the walls of COPA there. Real simple shelving display, though, that the tiles will just slide into. It'll be linear. And then we'll have a lot of pictures and a lot of information so that people can really see the whole story.
For more information on this, I suspect people can go to canvas.org.
Yes, sir.
Or just show up at the COPA on
Friday
night.
Just show up at COPA. Yeah, and it'll be up for the month. So if you miss out on Friday night, you'll have the whole month of February to check that out.
The Canvas's artistic coordinator, Brandon Howard, thanks for coming in today. Anything else you want to add?
Oh, that's it. Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
You're welcome, Brandon. Thank you. Bound by wild desire. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 3rd. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, we'll talk with biologist Kevin White about his Wildlife Wednesday presentation, The Ecology of Moose in Southeast Alaska. We'll get an update on activities at the Zach Gordon Youth Center with Donnie Barras. Andrea Campbell will fill us in on this year's Relay for Life. And Meryl Jensen will be here to highlight this first Friday presentation at KTOO featuring work inspired by the Jensen Olsen Arboretum. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Wednesday on a Juno Afternoon. The weather tonight, decreasing clouds, lows 16 to 24. And Wednesday, partly cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny. Thursday, sunny, very windy. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.